to those who joined us last night. So most of you were here for the recitation of the universal encouragements for Zazen, Fukan Zazengi. And there was a place in there where it said, I think it says something like, don't be suspicious of the true dragon. Does it say something like that?
Do not doubt the true
dragon. Do not doubt the true dragon. Okay. I agree. So here's an announcement for a talk tomorrow, and it's also for the whole session. The Buddha's Turn the Wheel of Dharma in the Midst of Fierce Flames. So we're considering the Buddha's, we're contemplating the Awakened One's Turning the Wheel of Dharma in the Midst of Fierce Flames. And the announcement also says, the flames of racism, mass incarceration, gun violence, many types of oppression, intolerance of diversity, many ways in which we see and experience suffering, and virtually infinite surround of delusion and suffering. Buddhas sit in the middle of all that. How can we be Buddhas sitting upright, clearly observing, and responding appropriately? I'd like to do a little ceremony of Sangha integration. May I? So I'd like to ask each of you to say your first name and then pause and let everybody say your name. Okay?
Jack.
Jack.
Anne.
Co.
Bill.
Bill.
Dylan.
Dylan.
Emily.
Emily.
Adam.
Adam.
Andrus.
Andrus.
Steve.
Steve.
Electra.
Electra.
Oracut.
Oracut.
Trent.
Trent. Marion, Corey,
Vicky,
Carrie,
Paula,
Gempo,
Genjo,
Mio-O,
Myoshin,
Myoshin,
Sosan,
Sosan,
Fukutoku.
Motoku.
Karin.
Karin.
Shodo.
Shodo.
Taizen.
Taizen.
Dainé.
Dainé.
Shodo.
Shodo.
Myo-on.
Myo-on.
Flying fish.
Flying fish.
Joan.
Joan.
Alan.
Alan.
Gyokujun.
Gyokujun. Jen,
Ryan,
Jason,
Fushin,
Kikan,
Kyoku,
Jenny,
Tenryu,
Shinko,
Ali,
Patricia,
Renata,
Kuge,
Reb.
Reb.
Again, may I say that we also, all of us, each of us, are sitting in the center of an ocean of delusion and an ocean of enlightenment. The Buddhas are sitting with us. The Buddhas are practicing with us. And because they're practicing with us, we are practicing with them. And because of that, we fully possess the wisdom and virtues of Buddhas. But because of some, perhaps, attachment to some stories, we don't realize it. So we need to train. And so we are training. In the activity of the Buddhas in the center, the turning the wheel of the Dharma, this Buddha activity can also be called the real dragon. The real dragon is surrounded by carved dragons, by stories of dragons. The real dragon is, you could say, is invisible. Or another way to put it, the real dragon is deportment beyond seeing and hearing. The real dragon is what, in the chant last night, is called Zazen. But there's the real dragon Zazen, and then there's the carved dragon Zazen. And some people have come and told me that they had a carved dragon of Zazen before this session, and they liked it quite a bit. And their carved dragon's getting challenged by these intimations of the real dragon. The real dragon doesn't mean to insult any of the carved dragons. The real dragon includes all the carved dragons. Any of your stories about what Zen practice is, about what Zazen is, about what the Buddha way is, all those carved dragons of the Buddha way are completely included in the real dragon of Zazen. And Zazen is totally in all the carved dragons. They interpenetrate each other. But if we have a carved dragon and we don't understand that, then sometimes when the real dragon's revealed, it can be a bit of a shock. So maybe you probably, some of you know the story of a Chinese aristocrat. I think his name was the Duke of Zhou, or Duke Zhou. And he loved carved dragons. He loved painted dragons. And being a duke, he could afford to, you know, acquire lots of statues and paintings of dragons in his estate. And so there he was at his estate, loving these carved dragons, and then a real dragon happened to come by. And the real dragon said, well, he likes dragons, maybe he'd like to meet me. So he flew down to the terrace of the palace of the Duke of Zhou. And the Duke saw the carved dragon and passed out, went unconscious. So the revelation of the real dragon in consciousness can be overwhelming. Consciousness can't actually reach the real dragon, but the real dragon can illuminate consciousness. And the real dragon does not destroy the carved dragon. They're working together all the time at the center of all beings. And the real dragon is practicing together. And there's, it turns out there's more than one real dragon. There's many real dragons, many Buddhas, and they're all practicing with each of us nonstop. At the center. With us. It's the place to be. It's the place we are. And it's non-stop challenge. Sometimes you might be kind of at ease with the challenge. Sometimes you might resist it. But the challenge is there, available for integration. The Buddha activity. Again, it's deportment, it's activity beyond hearing and seeing. And it's also not within reach of feeling or discrimination. People have a feeling, I had a feeling of the real dragon. Well, that's fine, but that feeling doesn't reach the real dragon. But it's a nice, but somebody else had a really creepy feeling of the real dragon. It was really nauseating or upsetting. But anyway, those feelings don't reach it. And any discrimination, this is the real dragon and that's not the real dragon, those are carved dragons, those are flames. So part of the Buddha's work, of course, is to sit and listen to all and observe all the flames and to see the Dharma in all the flames, to see the real dragon in the carved dragon. A couple of days ago, Genpo, formerly, or maybe still, Michael, said something like, something like this. What's the appropriate relationship with willful effort? What, is it something like that? You want to say it again yourself? Yeah. Did you hear it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the appropriate relationship with willful effort? Well, and I said to him, well, appropriate means to the point. The root of the word appropriate is to the point. So the question is, what's the point? If the point is Buddha activity, if the point of your life is turning the wheel of Dharma, then the appropriate relationship with willful effort is compassion. So the place where Buddhas are practicing is surrounded by willful effort. Some people are willfully trying to help somebody. Some people are willfully trying to exclude somebody. Some people are willfully trying to put themselves above other people. Some people are willfully trying to put themselves below other people. Various, you know, maybe if I put myself below everybody, nobody will hurt me. Maybe if I put myself above everybody, nobody will hurt me. Looking for some safety in the fire by willful effort. Flames, you know, fight fire with fire. The Buddhas are not exactly fighting fire with fire. They're not even fighting. They're embracing the flames with compassion, the flames of willful effort. Willful effort is could also be a translation of the word karma. Karma is a, means literally, no, excuse me, not a translation. The translation of karma is action. A definition of karma could be willful effort, intentional effort, volitional effort. Those are those are like a definition of karma. The translation of karma is action. It's a type of action which is willful, and not just willful, but self-willful. It's the will of a, it's a will in a consciousness where there's a self. What's the appropriate relationship to willful effort in relationship to an individual independent self? The appropriate relationship is compassion. With compassion towards karma, we can wake up to the Buddha activity which is with us already. Did you hear that? Can you say it back to me? Good. With compassion to karmic activity, we can awaken to Buddha activity, which is already present, nonstop. The Buddha activity is a ceaseless effort. It's an effort. Buddhas are hard-working Buddhas. There's no lazy Buddhas. Some bodhisattvas are occasionally lazy. Some have gotten over that. But Buddhas are, you know, they've been trained so long that they're ceaselessly making wholehearted effort. But the effort is not willful. It's not self-centered. They don't think they're doing it. A long time ago they did, and they practiced compassion towards that added, that carved dragon of practice, and they've gotten over it. Now they make a willful effort which is not karmic. It's not, did I say willful effort? No. Now they make an effort that's not willful. It's not volitional. It's, you know, it's aspirational. But they don't think I do it. And, but the activity is happening. And it is what they are. What they are is the activity. They are not doing the effort, they are the effort. Buddhas are the unceasing effort in the middle of all beings. What kind of effort? The effort to free all beings from their karmic effort, to free all beings from their willful effort so they may live in peace and harmony. It's a nonstop effort that's not karmic. And actually, all of us occasionally have an activity which is not karmic. We have, I think, yeah, the categories of karma could also be applied to the categories of action which is not karmic. For example, fingernails growing is not karmic. It's not intentional. When your Buddha's, your fingers grow just like Buddha's fingernails. Your hair grows. It's not karmic. It's an activity. If somebody chokes me, I go, I don't think, well, I did that. And they didn't do it, but our interaction gave rise to, when when somebody taps your knee in a certain way, your calf might pop out. It's not karmic. If it's karmic, the person who's tapping can tell the difference between intentional, pretending to have a reflex, and the reflex. So this kind of activity is possible. And this kind of activity, especially like with words and things like that, shows people that it's possible and shows them the way to become free of karmic entrapment. Free of the entrapment of, I do this, I don't do that. Free of these flames of, I did that, I didn't do that. Free of the carved dragons of Zazen that I do or don't do. And so they use images like a scarecrow. It's sitting there in the fields, perhaps the fields of Minnesota. There it is. And it has this function, but it doesn't think about scaring the birds, and yet the birds are scared. It has a function. It doesn't take it personally. Or in Japan, they have this thing called scare deer, the device, which is a bamboo tube, and they put it in gardens and let water run into it. And it's set so that as the water fills the tube, one end's open and one end's closed, as it fills the tube tilts and pours the water out. And when it pours the water out, it tilts back. And when it tilts back, it goes, and the deer goes, ooh, it's scary, and stops eating the plants for a while. Someone might say, well, that was really violent. But anyway, not so violent as other ways. And it's nice if the deers don't get too close to hunters. So the scare deer could be quite a kind thing. But the scare deer, and a human could also scare the deer. But the human might think, I'm scaring them. Whereas the scare deer doesn't think, I'm scaring them. It just scares them. And doesn't think, I'm being filled with water, and now I'm tilting, and here goes the water out of me, and I'm going to flop back there pretty soon and make a nice sound. It just does it. And really, we do too. All of our action really is like that. Causes and conditions come, and we sit up and say, hello, or goodbye. We don't do that. The whole universe that's surrounding us makes us into what we are. And that's the activity which Buddhas are transmitting. Studying the carved dragon of our karmic activity helps us be compassionate to it. Being compassionate to it helps us study it. Does that make sense? To be kind to your stories about you doing stuff and not doing stuff helps you see what's going on and how that's confusion and suffering. Did you get that? The thought that I'm doing this talking, if I believe that, I don't, but if I believed it, it's stressful for me, and I transmit that stress to you, which you might say, hey, thanks for the opportunity to be kind to the stress you're experiencing. But I don't believe what I'm saying. It's not very stressful. So I can just talk like this until you tell me to shut up. Not yet? In order to see clearly how your dragon carving's going on and how the idea that you're doing it is stressful, to say the least, in order to see that, you have to be kind to the process. If you're kind to the process, you will you will come into a state called clearly observing, and you will see the teaching that the Buddhas are showing all the time. But if you're not kind to your karmic activity at the center, or even if you go off the center to try to be kind to it, the place to be kind to it is where you are, not to go to some other neighborhood where it's hotter or colder. Where you are, just sitting here, that's why we have this session, to sit at your place and open up to the flames. And some of the flames are called resistance to the flames, and open to those too. As you open to them, they drop away. As you open to them, you see what they are, and they drop away. What are they? The flames. They drop away. They don't go away. They're not destroyed. They just drop away and reveal the Dharma. And then the Dharma starts getting, then you can see how the Dharma is being turned where you are. The other way around is if you study it, it enhances your ability to practice. If you study your karmic consciousness, that also enhances your ability to practice compassion. So compassion helps you illuminate your dragon carving, and studying dragon carving helps you see where to apply the compassion. It shows you where the way you see things is painful. Helps you hear the cries of karmic consciousness. So the Buddha's not trying to basically get us to do different kind of karmic consciousness, just pointing out that this kind of karmic consciousness is painful, this kind of karmic consciousness is also painful, but this kind of karmic consciousness helps you study karmic consciousness, so it's called good karmic consciousness. And the kind of karmic consciousness which makes it harder to study is called negative karmic consciousness. So it's part of the study. So Buddha's basically not so much saying, well, the Buddha does say that, do the karmic consciousness, the good kind, avoid the not good kind. But that's also to help you look at it, to help you study it. So one, again, one classical story about this is case 37 of the Book of Serenity, which is called Guishan's Karmic Consciousness. So the teacher in the story, his name is Guishan, and he has a disciple named Yangshan. And he says to his disciple, if someone comes up to you and suddenly says, all sentient beings just have karmic consciousness, boundless and unclear and giddy. Do you know what giddy means? What? You can't remember to study. You forget your vowels because you're so excited. Karmic consciousness is normally very excited, and it makes it hard to study. So all sentient beings got is karmic consciousness, boundless, unclear, giddy, and there's no fundamental on which it relies. If someone comes up to you and says that to you, how would you test that? And Yangshan said, I would say to them, hey you, if they turn their head, I would say, what is it? And I'll put a little bracket in there. If someone comes and says that, I would say, hey you, if they turn their head, brackets, that's the real dragon. When they turn their head, when you say, hey, you, they're not thinking, well, what should I do? What should I do? To answer, hey you. The head just turns. If you say hey you to a Buddha, the Buddha's head would turn. If you set it to the side. If you say it right in front, the Buddha just looks straight ahead. And if you say it over to the right, the Buddha's head turns to the right. You say it to the left, Buddha's head turns to the left. That's why you shouldn't ask the Buddha from behind. Don't do that. Come around either to the side, the front's best. Then the Buddha doesn't have to move her head. But, in fact, if you do ask the side, Buddha will say, yes. Or, just. So if a monk comes and asks that, I say, hey, you, if his head turns, we got Buddha activity. In other words, this is not a sentient being at that moment. This is Buddha. At that moment, you're Buddha. When your fingernails are growing out, Buddha would not grow those fingernails any differently than you are. It's just that Buddha completely accepts the way they're growing, and you might say, I wish they were a little bit longer. I wish they grew a little faster, a little rounder. I wish they had more paint on them. But even if you think, I wish they were longer, you don't have to be the least bit different from that to be Buddha. You just have to be more that way, completely. So, if they turn their head, they pass the first test. So then I'll give them another one. What is it? If they hesitate, then I say, we got a sentient being here. And all they've got is karmic consciousness, boundless and giddy. And the giddiness got them, and they hesitated with no fundamental to rely on. And then there's another story commenting on this, which is basically the same story. You want to hear it?
Mm-hmm.
So a monk was talking to another ancestor, whose name I think was Nan'an. And Nan'an said, no, the monk said to the teacher, in the Avatamsaka Sutra, in the Flower Adornment Scripture, it says, of all things, the fundamental affliction of ignorance, the affliction of ignorance, the affliction of ignorance, those are the flames, right? The affliction of ignorance, racism, sexism, ageism, republicanism, democratism, all those isms, all those delusions, those fundamental afflictions, they are themselves the immutable knowledge, the unchanging knowledge of all Buddhas. The flames are the turning of the wheel of the Dharma. So the flames aren't really flames, and the turning the wheel isn't really turning the wheel. The turning of the wheel is the flames, and the flames are turning the wheel. They're interpenetrating each other. The turning the wheel of Dharma, that sounds pretty good to me. Flames of suffering sound pretty bad. But this teaching is this excellent thing of turning the wheel of Dharma is not better than the purpose of turning it, which is all these suffering beings. Suffering beings aren't better than the turning of the wheel. They just are totally integrated with it. There's no turning of the wheel without suffering beings. So, you know, in early Buddhism, there's the turning of the wheel, and then there's delusion. There's the truth, the highest truth, and then there's the truth for deluded people. Two truths. In this teaching, there's three. One is the ultimate, the other is the relative, and the third is they're the same, and they include each other. So neither one are really what they are. So anyway, the monk quotes this, the Flower Adornment Scripture, and says, that seems really hard to understand. that the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas is the fundamental affliction of ignorance. And the teacher says, oh, really? I don't think so. Watch this. And there was a kid sweeping nearby. And the teacher called out to the kid and said, can you guess what he said? Hey, you. I don't know which of those stories happened first. But anyway, I don't know if he heard about Yangshan or Yangshan heard about him, or if they just both discovered this wonderful technique called hey, you. So the teacher said, hey, you, to the kid, and the kid's head turned. And the teacher said, under his breath, to the monk, is this not the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas? And then he said to the kid, what's Buddha? And the kid hesitated and was lost and wandered off into the horizon. I should say sunset, probably. And then he turns to the monk and said, is this not the fundamental affliction of ignorance? They're right there together. But that hesitation, that can turn and become the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. And the immutable knowledge can turn and be the fundamental affliction. There's no fixed position for the ultimate or the relative. They're both there all the time for us to enjoy. And again, some people might say, I'm up for enjoying the ultimate. I just don't want the relative. Some of the people, the relative is good enough for me. I don't want the ultimate. Well, fine, but you have no choice. The ultimate, the true principle of things is present in the particular things. All the particular things contain what's the same about all the particular things. And part of the work of liberating beings is to reveal the ultimate principle of Dharma by caring for the temporary, the partial, the visible, the tangible, the tasteable. We are surrounded by all sentient beings, and we are surrounded by all Buddhas. We are practicing with them all. And again, we're now in this situation called Sesshin. In Sesshin one time, I think Suzuki, she said, Zazen is the great tenderizer. If you just sit at your place in the middle of the flames, your body and mind will become tender. And you'll be able to be tender towards the flames. And if we can be tender with the flames, the Dharma will be revealed in that tenderness. But we sometimes have to sit with the flames for quite a while before we start to tend to be tenderized. Like I sometimes use the image of, at the beginning of Sesshin, some of us are like a house plant or even outdoor plant that's sitting in dry earth. And if you pour water onto the earth around us, the water just runs off. But if you just spray a little mist on the water, it might not run off, but sink in. And then spray a little more, and spray a little more, the water starts to gradually seep down, and the earth around the plant gets soft, more and more moist, and more and more receptive. And by the end of Sesshin, you can just pour water on, and it just goes right in. It doesn't run off. So sitting this way, one of the great things about it is we become more and more porous and tender. And after a while, everything that comes to us is Dharma. I mean, we see that. It's always the case. Everything that's coming is coming to teach us. Everything that's coming is coming to awaken us. But some things we say, no, this is not here to awaken me. No, no, no. This is here for me to reject. Now I'm rejecting it. Rather than this cruelty that I see is here to help me awaken so I can protect myself and other people from cruelty. When you awaken to cruelty, you see the Dharma and you see how to protect beings from cruelty. There's somebody in this sangha who told me that she's a martial arts teacher. And I don't know if I told her, but I'll tell her now. Buddha was a martial arts teacher. He knew how to respond in an artful way to attacks, to huge flames, to big insults, to huge waves. He knew how to like get up and surf on them. So we can learn that by being compassionate to the flames. We'll learn how to artfully protect beings from them. And trying to control them or get them to be smaller or bigger is not the work of compassion. The work of compassion is to wake up and be free without tampering with anything and to respond in a way that protects and liberates beings in the current situation. The appropriate response comes from the center of all things, where we happen to be. I thought I might tell you that occasionally, like this morning, there was a karmic consciousness that was looking for this little box and couldn't find it. And got a little giddy, started to feel giddy about not being able to find this box. And then some compassion came to the not being able to find it. And then it was found. But I did think, oh, there was some giddiness there. There was a kind of missing a few beats of compassion. Compassion for what? For where's that box? And then there was even a thought, kind of a controlling thought, well, you know, you'll be all right without those hearing aids. You can just ask people to speak up or come closer. It's not that bad not to be able to find these. And then I thought of the last time I came here, I was looking for my shoes. I just bought these new shoes, and then right after I got here, they disappeared. And I thought somebody, you know, what do you call it? Merrells are very popular, and they look quite similar sometimes. So I thought somebody probably just thought, and there's also Merrell knockoffs. So it's probably somebody with a Merrell knockoff put on my Merrells and walked off with them and didn't notice it. And then came back wearing a different pair of shoes. And that's what happened. Months later, the person wrote me a letter saying, I realized that I'm the one who took your shoes. But there was a karmic consciousness which was looking for those shoes during the session. I kept going, I kept walking over there willfully looking for the shoes again and again. And somebody in session loaned me an extra pair of his shoes, so I did have shoes to wear. But yeah. There is karmic consciousness. I'm not trying to get rid of mine, or the one where I live. I'm not trying to get rid of it. I don't recommend you try to get rid of it. Buddha didn't get rid of it. Buddha's not telling you to get rid of it. Buddha's saying, practice compassion towards karmic consciousness. Study it. And that's what Buddhas are doing. And that's what we're invited to do. Is there anything you want to bring up before we conclude this Dharma event? Yes?
I guess thinking about taking a step back.
Yes?
Now there's some of the teachings that talk about with that giddiness, like taking a step back from that.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the symbolism that we've been talking about, I'm wondering, you know, where that is.
Could you hear her question? Mm-hmm. She heard that in the midst of the giddiness, one could hear the instruction, step back or take the backward step or learn the backward step. So one understanding of learn the backward step might be that you take a step back from the giddiness, okay? But and I'm not saying that's wrong, but I think for me it's more like the backward step is to do something different with the giddiness than you usually do. Because usually you don't study it. You say, there's some giddiness here. The backward step is really to look at it. So it says, learn the backward step which turns the light around. So usually karmic consciousness is giddy and looking out at, it's not looking at itself, which enhances the giddiness, because the giddiness does well when not observed. It grows. But if you turn the light around and back and on the giddiness, you get to see, oh, there's giddiness, plus also there's a self there. And the self kind of is like all mixed in with the giddiness. Maybe the giddiness is dependent on this appearance, this self. And then, so again, the backward step is to now look at the self and look at what the self appears to be. And I'm just stop for a second and tell you that there's a little four-part teaching about what goes with that sense of self, but I'm not going to say it right now. I'm just going to say that the one understanding of the backward step is you turn your awareness and point it in the other direction where it's usually pointed. That's the backward step. To illuminate the place from which we usually are looking outward, look inward, and then you'll start to see the self, and then you can study that and start to see what's going on there. That's what I would say the backward step is. Now, if you're ready for the next part about the four parts. Mm-hmm. So in karmic consciousness, generally speaking, when it's operating, there's a sense of self. If there's no sense of self, I would say let's not use the word consciousness for that, which is part of that, you know, ego tunnel book. So let's use consciousness for where there's a self. And we have much more cognitive activity than consciousness. We have a tremendously complex, high-speed internet. That's where they got the idea. The high-speed internet got put up into consciousness, and now we're conscious of it. But it's been there all along. Very high-speed internet. Is our own high-speed internet faster than the other one? People will try to find that out pretty soon. Whether our own is faster. But they're both very fast. Ours doesn't need any extra electricity other than the electricity that comes from rice. So we've got high-speed internet, we've got consciousness, which is relatively very slow, but it can do things that the internet can't do. One of the main things it can do is it can turn the light around on itself. The unconscious can't do that. It's amazing. But it can't study itself, and it doesn't have a self. Our consciousness has a self, and it can study itself. It can receive teachings about how to study itself. It can receive teachings about how hard it is to study itself. For example, whenever there's a sense of self, there's four afflictions taught by Vasubandhu in the 30 verses. Self-view, self-confusion, self-love, and self-pride. All three of these are three kinds of affliction that come with the self. So one of the afflictions, one of the pains of having a self in the consciousness is that it seems like everything's being looked at from the self. It's not. So you got a self and you got the consciousness that has the self, and then there's this affliction which is not the self and is not the consciousness. It's an affliction that lives in self-consciousness, which is the idea or the view that what's going on here is being looked at from the self. It's not, though. It's just an idea that it's being looked at from the self. That's just a pain in our life that we think we're looking at the world. The world's looking at the world through us, really. And then there's self-confusion, like that's me, that's not me. That's my body, that's not my body. That's my friend, that's not my friend. This is mine, this is not mine. That, you know, my body is me, my body is not me. I don't know, is my body me or not? Well, is the taste of me me? Are my thoughts me or not me? There's a lot of confusion about whether what's going on is me or not me. And it's stressful, that confusion. And then there's self-pride, which is basically, how great to have a self, and also, am I speaking loudly enough? Mm-hmm. How great I got a self, but also, this self is so great, this self actually can control what's going on. That's really, really an affliction. And along with that affliction, when we try to follow through and exercise that affliction by trying to control what's happening, We notice that it's not working, and we get, and then there's fear. And then we think, oh, I have to try to control more, and then we have more fear. So this self-pride leads to the, what's the word, contraindicated effort to control what's going on. Whereas actually, that's not going to be possible. What's actually going on is consciousness arises, and it comes with a self. The self and the consciousness arise together. The self doesn't make the consciousness come up. The self doesn't make the consciousness come up. The consciousness doesn't make the self come up. They come up together. They're like siblings. But as you know, some human siblings think they made their brothers and sisters. Then maybe their parents say, no, I made them. Like my granddaughter, when she was pretty young, I had mentioned to her that her mother, she knew her mother was, and her mother, she knew her mother was hers. Now, she didn't necessarily think she made her mother, but she thinks her mother, she had this self-confusion. My mother, that person is my mother. I own, that's mine. That's my mother. That mother is mine. She got that quite early, and nobody told her that, I don't think. So she's old enough to know that was my mother. And then I even said, I went along with it and said, your mother is my daughter. Or I could have said, your mother, you do own her. But anyway, she also is, I'm her father. And she's my daughter. And my granddaughter says, no, she's not. She's my mother. And she didn't even say, and she's also my brother's mother. She said, she's my mother. She's not your daughter. She's not your wife's daughter. She's my mother. This is like self-confusion. Now, I didn't press it, so she didn't get too distressed about it all. She was a little bit distressed to get this message, this strange message that she was somebody, she had a relationship with somebody else. And then time went on, and her mother's really a great person and gradually softened her up, tenderized her up, and gradually sort of said, well, actually, I do have a dad like you do, and that's my dad. No. Little by little, she's accepted, okay. She has a relationship with him and her and him. Okay, I'm not the only person in the world she has a relationship with. But, you know, basically this self-pride thinks amazingly untrue things about its power. And it exercises them, and it creates various kinds of affliction and harm and fear. And then there's self-love, which I'm not sure exactly how to elaborate on that, but anyway, it's kind of like it's kind of like, even though this self thing is such a problem, you know, like people often say to me, I am so sick of myself. I'm sick of this self thing. Me. I'm so sick of it. And then, of course, I want to get rid of it. Which, again, Buddha's not recommending getting rid of it. That's just more of the same thing. But then they can, but actually, I don't really know if I would want to get rid of it because it's awfully dear to me. Maybe I'll just keep it even though I'm so confused and so on about it. I got to work on this self-love thing to clarify that for you more later. Is that enough for this morning? I got a yes and I got a Gassho. The Gassho trumps yes.
Can a carved dragon breathe real fire?
Can a carved dragon breathe real fire? Nobody can breathe real fire. Not even a real dragon. The real dragon isn't really a real dragon. So, and real fire isn't really real fire. The flames aren't real. If they are, we wouldn't be able to become free of them. But we can, without getting rid of them. You don't have to get rid of unreal things. So I wouldn't say that the carved dragon can breathe real fire or the real dragon can breathe real fire. But there is fire, and the real dragon and the carved dragon work together in the process of arising with fire and arising with the appearance of real fire and unreal fire. Those two dragons, those two kinds of dragons, always working together to create this universe. The real dragon is like the loom, and the carved dragon is like the shuttle, and they work together to create the classical brocade of Buddha way. But they can't operate separate from each other. And the real flames and the fake flames can't operate separate from each other. So the real flames aren't really real, and the unreal flames aren't really unreal. That's our family style.
That's our what?
Our family style.
I'm sorry.
That's the Zen family style, style, which is sometimes called the wind. So then we have this expression, the wind of the house, or the wind of the family. The wind of the family is the ultimate truth. Although it's ultimate and it's wonderful and it's liberating, it's liberating. It can set you free. You can't be free without the ultimate truth. The convention, but you can't use the ultimate truth without the conventional truth. The conventional truth does not liberate you. You need the ultimate truth, which is that the conventional truth and the ultimate truth are not really what they are. Okay? You knew that wasn't a real flame, right? Yes?
You spoke about self-pride. Thinking that we can make things happen?
That, or thinking that you control what is happening?
Yes.
Yeah, similar.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, it's sort of obvious that that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that we do when we chant the Dahisan Dharani? Or the other chants?
We're chanting.
Yeah.
And whatever we do, whatever activities are occurring in karmic consciousness, like if we think we're chanting the Dahisan Dharani, even if I don't think I'm doing it, we're doing it, that has consequence. And the way we think about how we're chanting can vary, and whatever way we think about it, whatever way we imagine we're doing it, transforms our body and mind. Has consequence. What we're doing is the carved dragon. What we're doing is karmic consciousness. Simultaneously, the Buddhas are practicing with us while we're chanting the Dahisan Dharani, and they're rooting for us to open up to what's going on here, namely that while we're chanting for the Dahisan Dharani, we're simultaneously calling for compassion. And while we're chanting the Dahisan Dharani, we're listening to the suffering of the world. The Dahisan Dharani is about listening to the suffering of the world. It's an invocation of compassion. So while we're chanting an invocation of compassion, we're also practicing compassion. And if we're not practicing compassion, we're just missing out that we're practicing compassion while we're chanting in the invocation of compassion. And if you to practice compassion while you're chanting the great compassion mind Dharani, to practice it simultaneously helps you wake up to what, you know, the reality of what you're doing, which is, and the reality is that there's an ultimate truth of what you're doing, which is that what we're, when we're chanting, we're enacting emptiness, but also we're enacting chanting, where I'm enacting voice and sound. We're doing both of those, and they're integrating each with each other. We practice compassion while we're chanting. We open to the full interpenetration of all the things that are going on. That's what we're really doing, and practicing compassion is necessary for us to wake up to that. Because sometimes we do practice Daishin Rani, and there's no compassion in sight. We may just say, "I hate this chant. I don't like this chant. I don't want to practice chant. I don't feel any compassion, even though I know it. I remember it's about compassion." How's that?
It helps. I have fairly recently gotten interested, and so I chant it almost every day and go, what am I doing? What am I doing?
Well, that's part of compassion. Uh-huh. That's part of compassion, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow. Mm. What's part of compassion? What am I doing? To practice compassion without what am I doing is, you know, not fully inflated compassion.
Not fully inflated.
Sorry, but your compassion tires aren't full. Or they could even be over full if you don't say, what am I doing? And say, I think I put enough air in these compassion tires. I'm just going to tell you two stories about Daishin Dharani. One of them was in my first practice period of Tassajara, one of the monks told me that on one of our days off, he went up in the mountains and smoked marijuana. And when I think back, I didn't even say, "You're smoking marijuana in this monastery?" I just listened, kind of with amazement. And then he said, and when I came back from being up in the mountains smoking marijuana, and I went to evening service and we chanted the Daishin Rani, it was so cool. And then another time, we had a visiting teacher from Japan, and we had another day off, and we were having breakfast. On the days off, we have breakfast informally in the dining room rather than in the zendo. So at breakfast, this visiting teacher says, "Where is everybody?" There weren't very many people at breakfast. And he was informed that a lot of people went up to the top of the mountain to celebrate Easter. It was Easter. And they went up to be at the top of the mountain at sunset, and then at the top of the mountain to celebrate Easter, they were going to chant the Daishin Dharani. And this visiting teacher said, "I didn't know Christians knew the Daishin Dharani." So what are we doing? You know, well, what are we doing? That's part of compassion, big part of it. And also other people coming up to us and saying, "What are you doing?" Other people questioning me, that's part of compassion too. Them towards me, but also me receiving their questions is part of. So asking yourself, what are you doing? And listening to yourself ask the question, that's really the Daishin Dharani in action. But again, if you don't chant it, then it's kind of like you can't ask, what are you doing when you're chanting it? So one of the great advantages of chanting the Heart Sutra is while you're chanting, you can say, what are we doing? And one of the nice things about sitting here is you don't have much else to do, so you can just ask yourself, what are we doing? What am I doing? What are they doing? It's a nice opportunity to question what this life is. Sometimes you may feel, I'm too busy to ask what I'm doing. But in this session, you're not too busy, are you? And when you're chanting these things, which you don't understand anyway, you're not too busy. That's compassion. Compassion is, what is this karmic consciousness? Compassion isn't like, I know what it is, and it's bad. And that's true. Well, yeah, you can say it's bad, but that's just karmic consciousness talking. But to say, what is it? That's really part, that's compassion. That will reveal what it really is. Which it's the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. But that's not going to be understood without lots and lots of what is it? Who is it? Where is it? Who is it? Oh yeah, right. It's the world-honored one. So now I defer to the person who said that yes, it's enough.